You are listening to Sheep Might Fly, a podcast of serialized fiction written and read by Tansy Rayner Roberts. The next 2 weeks are going to be Creature Court themed standalone episodes because I'm very wrapped up in my Kickstarter campaign right now, and that's literally all I can think about. So I thought I'd share some bits and pieces to do with these books with you. And then when it's all done and I have my brain back again, post-Kickstarter brain, hopefully post-successful Kickstarter brain, otherwise I'll just be crying and drinking gin at you. So after the Kickstarter closes, we can start on our next reprint serial, which will be Cookie Cutter Superhero. Now, speaking of Cookie Cutter Superhero and the series of superhero stories I've written, I won some awards this weekend, like quite a lot of awards, kind of an alarming amount of awards. The Aurealis Awards were presented on Saturday afternoon, and I was up for 4 of them, and I actually won 4 of them, which, though not all 4 that I was nominated, I won 2 awards, 2 Aurealis's for Girl Reporter, which is in my Cookie Cutter Superhero series. That was a segue. That was the YA short fiction and the science fiction novella categories. That was really exciting. Even more exciting was to see the response of my publishers, the Book Smugglers, on social media as they found out that I'd won awards. It made them very happy. I also won an award for a short story, The Curse Has Come Upon Me Cried, which is part of a collection that I self-published last year. The collection is called Please Look After This Angel and Other Winged Stories. And that was a collection that I put together as a freebie to send out to my newsletter subscribers. So it was kind of amazing to have it nominated for things and picked up. I didn't win for Best Collection, which I was nominated for. But then I got a surprise award at the end of the ceremony, which I was following on live stream, because my collection of essays, The Fictional Mother, was given the Conveners Award for Excellence, which is where, basically with the Aurealis Awards, every different category has a jury who read all the work in that category, like science fiction short or science fiction novel or fantasy or young adult or whatever, which is why you often don't get a lot of logic from shortlist to shortlist. Sometimes you can have people appearing on multiple categories for multiple awards because they're all decided independently. And it's one of the things that's really cool about the Aurealis Awards is that it's a jury, but it's also a very well-read jury who've tried to read everything that's eligible that year in their category. So it really means a lot. And then the conveners are the people who like moderate each of the panels. They all get together and decide on one special award, and that's what the Fictional Mother received. So I was just blown away by this. This is all very surprising. Slightly less surprising for me, because we were worded up ahead of time, is that overnight, Saturday night, Australian time, the Hugo shortlists went out, and 2 of the podcasts that I record, basically all the podcasts except this one, don't feel left out. That's okay. But no, Galactic Suburbia, which is my science fiction discussion podcast I do with Elisa Krasnostein and Alex Pierce, was nominated for Best Fancast in the Hugo. We actually won that a few years ago, so it's really exciting still to be nominated, especially after you've won, because sometimes people think, okay, that's it, you're done, you can go out to pasture now. But no, we got nominated, which is lovely. And Verity, the Doctor Who podcast that I do with Deb Stanish, Erica Ensign, with Kat and with Liz. It was just, it's really great to have that nominated too. It does mean that I'm up against myself in a category, which, you know, has this faintly surreal, constant thread of potential guilt running through it. But hey, it's lovely. And lots of works that I really care about, people that I care about, got nominated too in the Hugos. It was a really great shortlist in a lot of ways. to have Luminescent Threads, which is the 12th Planet Press book about Octavia Butler, nominated, is so fantastic. Sarah Rhys Brennan's novel In Other Worlds, which I... In Other Lands. Terrible title, brilliant book. I can never remember the title. But it's one of the best fantasy books I've read in years. I'm so excited it's on the YA New Not a Hugo category. So many friends and great works on there. The whole thing just involved a lot of flailing. So that was very exciting. Oh, Kathleen Jennings, who... This is going to be another segue, but the wonderful Australian fantasy artist Kathleen Jennings... Can't believe she's never had a Hugo nomination before, but she has this year, which is such a big deal. It's really rare for, you know, for non-American artists to make it onto the artist list, the professional artist list for the Hugos. It's one of those categories that's really competitive. And, you know, it's just so exciting to see her on there. And then yesterday... because I'm still on the awards thing, Girl Reporter, still on my superhero series, also won the DITMA for Best Novella. So that was a really, like, this ridiculous, crazy weekend. Australia has now run out of awards, I think. There might be still a few more for offered up in June. We still got the Norma to come. But, yeah, it's kind of, we're used to the Aurealises and the DITMAs to be a bit more spaced out. So it's a bit alarming when they all happen on the same weekend. But, yeah, so... I've been talking too much. That was really exciting, though. Thank you to everybody who nominated and voted in the DITMAs, which is a fan-voted award. It's always lovely. And so I can sit and wait for some trophies to be delivered, because that's my life. Back to Kathleen Jennings, who's going to be doing the artwork for my beautiful Creature Court rebrand reprint series, which is what I'm kickstarting right now. The current state of the Kickstarter as of today, which is Monday the, I don't know, is it the 2nd? Monday the something of April. The current state of the Kickstarter, we're at 75%. 250 backers have still to raise to make the project happen, $3,642. And 10 days to go. So that's very exciting and stressful and alarming. It basically, as I said, it fills my head. It's all I can think about right now. Kickstarters, I've done these before, not one that was just for me or my stuff, but like it's group projects. It's a bit like childbirth. When you're not doing it, you forget how bad it is. Rather, how stressful, how full on, how much of your energy it takes. And when you're actively doing it, you're like, oh, I could do another one of those. That was really fun. It's going to feel so good when it stops. Right now I'm in an agony of anxiety and stress and all that, and being really positive because I love the project and I want to talk about it with everybody and not just like clutch them as they walk past and say, please pledge to my Kickstarter. That's all right. You guys know I'm a mess. It's fine. So I'm going to read you some Creature Court, because one of the things that's really kind of weird, I guess, about this project has been returning to this series of books that was such a big part of my life for so long. When you finish writing a book, and certainly when you finish editing it and it's published and it's out there, and maybe you finish promoting it because you're onto new things, there's this sense of leaving something you really cared about behind. You know, you're so immersed in a world. And The Creature Court is really the only time that I've had that thing of I'm writing a trilogy, which then has an ending, and then you put your laptop down and you walk away from it and you're done. And I'd left a door open for myself. Part of me did not feel 100% done with The Creature Court, despite the fact that those who read it know that it finishes very sad, very completely in a very kind of, you know, I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but, you know, it has a finish. But I always had a thought in my head of, well, how would I come back to it? How would I, what stories would I still tell in that world? And because it's a story, I love the city that I built for these novels. And I spent so much time there. You know, I was started writing these books properly in 2004. And between writing and not writing and selling and editing and writing more and editing and writing more and doing all that stuff. And then the book's coming out between 2010 to 2012. That's a huge part of my life where I was just immersed in the world of Alfleur, which is all 1920s frocks and cabaret and Victorian music hall and a version of the city of Rome that I remember from when I visited there in 2002, but my version really bears little resemblance to the real one because memory is like that. Now, I spent so much time there with those characters, and then at the end I walked away, and now it's 6 years later and I'm back, and I've had to rereading my own books for a start. I've already done the layout of the original three books. I did that while I was editing and revising and rereading them, throwing myself back in the world because I knew I'd have to remember what it was like to live there in order to promote the Kickstarter, but also to write new stories. I'm writing a novella, which is kind of a prequel. It's set during a time period during the first book, but it's before the big narrative begins. And yeah, I had in mind writing all these little stories. My plan is that if I fill the Kickstarter early, I'm going to write these like micro fiction every day until the campaign's over. And I've got this sense of it's like I'm writing fanfic of my own work, but it's long enough to go that it doesn't 100% feel like a book that I wrote. I remember writing it. It's one of those things I wrote because I wanted to read it. So yeah. Again, I've been talking too long. I'm going to read you guys a chapter. It's actually one of my favourite chapters of the first book, Power and Majesty. It's not right at the beginning because I've already kind of been circulating the first chapter a bit. This was actually the original first chapter of the original manuscript before it was picked up and more was written and all that stuff. Because I originally wanted to tell the story pretty much starting right in the centre of the action, and I was talked out of it, and thank goodness, because yeah, there would have been too much to explain. Basically, there was too much empty space if I started right when I wanted to start. So this is actually the last chapter of the end of the first section of the book. And Velody, our protagonist, came to the city of Alfleur just at the beginning of her teenage years to become an apprentice dressmaker. And the first night she was there, she came into her powers, this strange power in which she saw the world differently. And it completely terrified her. And she was given the opportunity to just get rid of it all by a rather predatory, handsome young man who wanted her power for himself. And so he took it, which is all very well. But that sort of thing always comes back to bite you. And this is the story of what happens 8 years later when that handsome young man has died. And the powers that he stole, not just from Velody, but from other people, get returned. And this is where the narrative, the story, really kicks into gear and everything is just terrible for a long time, which sums up a lot of what happens in these books. Everything is terrible for everybody, but they hang together and sometimes there's comforting cups of tea or pretty naked men, you know, whichever. So, first day of the Floralia, maidens, before dawn. It was still dark for the most part. Velody hugged her thick wool shawl around her shoulders. Delphine kept up a steady stream of mutter in her ear about the cold wind and the shoving, restless crowd around them in the packed forum, and most especially about how stupid spring festivals couldn't have parades starting in the middle of the day instead of an hour before sunrise. Even above the noise of the crowd and the garland sellers, they could hear the distant tinny sounds of cymbals and spring song. The Floralia parade was getting closer. "Let's just go home," Velody said suddenly, losing her nerve. "It's not like we'll see a thing in this mash." "Are you kidding me?" replied Delphine, grasping Velody's sleeve tightly with her painted nails. We're not leaving until we see the Duchess's dress. Velody reached out and tweaked the pink flower garland that rested on Delphine's head. Well, if you insist. The forum was awash with lopsided pink and white rose crowns and trailing ribbons as the crowd gathered. There were people everywhere, a hungry mob spending a fortune on sweet fruit, candies, and romantic tokens for each other, while they hustled to get the best position to view the parade. Some of them had set up makeshift scaffoldings to clamber up on, while others hung from balconies and upper windows of the churches and public buildings. My neck's cold, Delphine complained. Shouldn't have cut your hair off then, should you? You should try it. Such a liberating feeling to give up the snood and bobby pins forever. Velody touched her own dark hair defensively and a shower of white petals from her festival garland scattered on the pavement. Shoddy workmanship. I blame the garland maker, said Delphine. It was one of yours. The rosy tips of dawn edged over the hills of the city. Floralia was about to begin. Somewhere in the distance they could hear cymbals as the parade approached. Darlings, shrieked a voice in the crowd, a toast for Floralia. Velody and Delphine rolled their eyes at each other. More of your grape juice, Willam? Delphine asked wryly. None of that, said the curly-haired cordialer, as he pushed his way through the crowd towards them, his vials rattling on a tray around his neck. This is the finest cherry hot drop, just right to warm the cockles. Delphine sniffed at the contents of the glass flasks. Sugar and cheap spirits. No thanks. She whimpered at Velody, who gave in and opened her shawl, so Delphine could share its warmth. I almost wish it was Saturnalia again. At least we could have hot cider and bean syrup. Roasted chestnuts, said Velody, her taste buds melting at the thought of it. Yum! Delphine turned her eyes on Willam. You don't have any roast chestnuts, I suppose. You should be so lucky, sweetheart. You won't get anything but rose dumplings and sugar violets from the vendors today. Don't you know it's Floralia? As if I could forget. Delphine leaned forward to tug at the lopsided garland that Willam wore over his curls. She hated to see a ribbon wreath worn sloppily. Sugar makes my teeth itch. No Rian today? Willam asked. She doesn't do too well with crowds these days, Velody said shortly. I don't blame her, said Delphine, changing the subject. Too many festivals in this hellish city. If I didn't make my livelihood from them, I'd complain to council. Sick of Floralia already, said Willam. 5 days to go. At least you can set aside the roses and pink ribbon after tomorrow, Velody reminded Delphine. Delphine huffed, taking more than her share of the shawl. Doesn't get any better. It's cords to wrap around hawthorn crowns next, with white and green silk for the calends, and then deeper reds for passion and abundance, then only a day or two to rest, before it's time to start threading shade garlands for the Lemuria. You're just cold and tired, said Velody. We can go home if you like. I'm sure we could squeeze through, and... No, Delphine said. You're going to watch this parade if it kills us both. Have you no sense of perspective? I hate seeing people wear my clothes, Velody sighed. They never look as good as on the mannequin. She had a secret dread that the roses would all have fallen out, leaving her client in nothing but a beaded silken slip and a fine translucent net. What a thimble-headed idea for a dress design and for an outdoor parade! She should have done something safer, less troublesome. So many future commissions rested on the reception of this one garment. Aren't you a pair of grizzling wenches? Commented Willam. Is it too much to hope you're here to enjoy the parade like everyone else? Parades, mocked Delphine. There are three a week at this time of year. It's not going to be anything new. This is the Duchess's first public appearance as ruler of the city since her mourning period for the old Duke ended, Willam said, in a gossipy voice. Aren't you interested to see who she's chosen as her spring consort? Delphine quirked an eyebrow up, slightly interested. One of the boys from the great families. But which one? There'll be a diplomatic incident, whichever lad she chooses. The one thing Hwalum and Delphine had in common was a lust for great families' gossip. It astounded Velody how a dame who couldn't name three historical battles or three great novels from the last century could rattle off aristocratic genealogies at a moment's notice. The crowd oohed and aahed as the head of the parade, a marching band in full regalia, finally appeared at the mouth of the forum. Velody watched them stomp with perfect choreography and wondered exactly how the seams had been sewn on their costumes. That livery satin was so slippery to work with. But if the Gorges are snubbed, the Palcini clan will be delighted, Hwilum said to Delphine. They were squabbling now. Another few minutes and they'd be laying bets. Velody concentrated on the parade instead. The Irene priestesses following the marching band, each swathed in fluttering white garments, and carrying a bundle of ceremonial scrolls bound with knotted cord. Behind them came the Silver Brethren, chanting and singing. I'll bet you a honey cake to Serenai that it's Atticus Alfrey, Delphine said. Their family dates back to the founding of the city. It's a conclusive way to establish precedence without making a commitment towards betrothal. I'll bet against that, Hwilum said in a businesslike voice. They spat and shook hands on it. A woman in the crowd tried to purchase a flask of rose water from him, but he waved her away as if she was annoying him. I'll bet you a chicken to the crossroads that our Duchessa chooses her consort from a family much closer to home. Does the name Zandelion mean anything to you? The Duchessa's own clan, Delphine frowned. But there isn't anyone except the cousins. Her eyes widened. None of them have set foot in the city for years, unless you know something I don't. I'm saying nothing more, Hwilum said smugly. Will you take my bet? No way. If I'm up for a honey cake, I can't afford a chicken as well. Her eyes narrowed. You took my bet on false pretences. If the Duke Comte or one of his brothers is here and you knew it, that's not fair. Of course she'd choose them above the others. A Zandelion would be the only spring consort that no one could get offended about. There was a sound of clopping horse hooves. Velody felt cold. Delphine, can we go? Of course not. Delphine squeezed her hand. Here they come. She shot a dirty look at Hwilum. We can't rely on him to tell us which way the bet turned out, or to describe what your dress looks like. Velody moaned, I can't feel my feet. Was this stage fright? The whole city would be looking at the Duchessa today, would already have seen her from Church Bridge to the Forum and along every main street in between. Velody's only consolation was that most of these watchers would have seen the thing in the half-light of lanterns and shadows. You've gone white, Hwilum said at her elbow. Drink this. Velody found a flask of cordial in her hand and gulped the contents. Delphine was right. The stuff was sickly, but she could feel her toes again, even if she was probably about to throw up. The horse-drawn pavilion was white, streaming ribbons in the breeze. Contrary to tradition, there were no pink flowers on the royal float, and it was immediately obvious why. Duchessa Isangel Zandelion d'Alfleur was dressed in pink in honour of the Floralia, and nothing would be allowed to upstage her. The most powerful woman in Alfleur stood waving to the crowds, her slim body clad in a simple fall of pink roses, bound to a knee-high beaded dress in the latest fashion, with ribbons trailing down to her feet. The Duchess's honey-coloured hair was pinned up in a garland of roses, and the sweet look on her face charmed the crowd, who screamed and threw flowers at her. It had been timed perfectly. The last of the Nox shadow faded from the sky as the Duchess's pavilion began the descent into the lower forum. The light of the sunrise gleamed off her gowns and ribbons. Not a petal out of place, Delphine crowed. Velody breathed out. Everything was all right. The dress was perfect, and it wouldn't be long before word spread that Velody of the Vitrine, Via Silviana, was responsible for it. She could already feel the pin calluses on her hands ache at the thought of all the new commissions. Maybe they'd actually have a month or two without having to rely on Delphine's garlanding to pay the council taxes, license fees, and living expenses for three people. Beautiful, said Willem. What a bloody picture. I didn't think you fancied dems or gowns, said Delphine. I'm not talking about that. No offence, Velody. I'm talking about that peach of a man. He is a stunner, Delphine agreed. Du Comte Achille Zandelian Delfleur, grandson of old Duke Inesco, said Willem with a smirk. My brother saw him leave the Orient Gate station last Knox. Delphine laughed. You rat! I owe you a honey cake for Serenai. They were talking about the spring consort. He was the dark and brooding type, at least 10 years older than his radiant cousin, and looked as uncomfortable in his white festival suit as the young duchessa was relaxed in her gown of roses. The man's collar was uneven, which suggested he'd been slouching around and tugging at it before the parade. A decent tailor should have recognised his hatred of formal attire and put him in a low-necked shirt. Velody frowned. She'd seen him before, hadn't she? He looked familiar. But his hair was so short, it should be falling his eyes. We're losing him, said Poet. Blast his bloody head off and suck him dry, said Priest. He'd do the same to you in a second. Velody had a splitting headache. For a moment as she watched the Duconte on the pavilion, she thought she saw a web of scars crossing his face, neck and arms. But then she blinked and they were gone. Did you see that? She asked. See what? Responded Delphine. Willem, cheerfully abandoning them now that he'd won his bet, raised his voice to the crowd. Floralia cordials, toast the new spring. Get your rose waters here, my lovelies. Someone raised a hand and he nipped off in that direction. Yes, seigneur, and a drop for the demoiselle. Blessings of the day, seigneur. Take it, you bastards, screamed Garnet. Velody staggered. The air tasted sweet and heavy. I don't feel well. Delphine took her arm. No wonder. Up every Knox working on that damn dress. I'll get you home. Can't breathe. Velody clawed her shawl away. Her skin was hot and sweaty. Pain stabbed through the veins at her temples. The sky, still not quite light, shivered, and for a moment it pressed down around her skin. When Velody looked up, she saw a sizzling bolt of gold light spinning towards her. She couldn't move away from it if she tried. Did anyone else see that? Or was she the only one? She opened her mouth to ask Delphine, then froze as the swirl of light slowed only inches from her face, waiting for something. Crazy. That was definitely crazy. She opened her mouth to speak, to make her excuses and leave this place. The gold light lashed out towards her, even as another spiral shot into the crowd, in the direction of the Duchess's pavilion. Velody gasped, breathing the light into her body. For a moment she thought she could see the stuff streaming out from under her fingernails. Someone screamed. Not her, thank goodness. A long bellow of masculine pain and outrage that tore into a second scream, and then a third. The crowd surged. Saints and devils! Exclaimed Willem a little way away, wrapping his arms protectively around his tray of cordials as a wave of people pushed past him. Delphine grabbed Velody and the two of them hung on to each other, moving with the mob rather than trying to fight against it. The Duchess's pavilion had stopped up ahead. Velody slammed against a hitching post and held on to it, in the hope that she wouldn't be dragged along any further. Delphine was ripped away from her and vanished into the crowd. Velody was afraid her friend had been crushed in the stampede, but the familiar blonde head surfaced a few minutes later, breathless and laughing. Half the mob were fleeing the forum, and the rest of them strained to see what had caused the excitement. Everyone who could craned their heads up at the bright white royal pavilion. Velody had an unexpectedly good view from where she stood. The Duchess's lictors, the honour guard who'd been marching behind the float at a discreet distance, were now cut off from the Duchessa and her consort by the milling crowd. Duconte Achille Zandelian d'Alfleur was screaming. He knelt among the white ribbons and sat in a halo of scorching golden light, bellowing with pain. The crowd muttered and stared at him, but none went to his aid except his cousin, the Duchessa, who hovered uncertainly over him as if he were a wounded child. And yes, Velody was not imagining those scars now. They webbed his face and neck and arms in ugly streaks. She stared with morbid fascination at the screaming man with the ruined skin. The dark ridged lines that had sliced his face into a twisted mess were moving, wriggling. The scars fell off his face like rivulets of water, and he screamed as if they burned as they left his skin. The Duconte's voice ran hoarse, and he gaped in silence as more scars dragged themselves from his hands and wrists, dripping off his fingers and leaving perfect, unmarked skin beneath. As he breathed, the golden light poured into his nose and mouth, glowing out of his eyes and from beneath his fingernails. "If I'm mad," Velody thought with a touch of hysteria, "he is too." It wasn't a comforting thought. The Duchessa reached out to her cousin, and he pulled her to him, burying his face in her gown of beaded silk and roses. Pink petals fell to the floor of the white pavilion. The lictors scrabbled towards the float with greater urgency, using their rods of state to bat people out of the way. Up ahead, Delphine glanced at Velody, across the heads of the onlookers that separated them, and shrugged. Velody was even more certain now that no one but herself, not even the Duchessa, currently cradling his face against her stomach, could see why the Duconte was in such pain. As she thought this, she saw a brown-cloaked man crouching on the sloped rooftop of the Council Curia across the way. Even from such a distance, she could see his eyes boring down upon the figure of the damaged Duconte. "He knows," Velody thought, then wondered why she was so sure. The cloaked man lifted his gaze to make eye contact with her. "He knows about me, too." She didn't know why she was suddenly so afraid, or what the stranger could possibly know about her, except that she could see the scars where no one else could. She glanced at her hands and was relieved to see no hint of the strange light that had entered her. The crowd slackened around the float, many of the witnesses losing interest in the tableau of ruling lady and mad consort. The Duconte drew away from the embrace with his cousin and stared at her with a fierce intensity. "Not at her," Velody thought, and this time panic rose fully within her. "He's looking at the dress." The Duconte's hands lunged out, grasping at the fragile fabric of the gown, and tearing violently at it. The silk ripped, and a cloud of petals exploded around him as he tore the Duchess's dress away from her stomach. The crowd gasped with delicious horror. The Duchessa looked stunned as her cousin brandished a handful of torn pink silk, beads, ribbon, and roses at her. "What is this?" he bellowed in pure rage. "What are you?" The young Duchessa squealed as her cousin pushed her back on the pavilion, covering his body with hers, scrabbling his hands over her pale and perfect face. "You're not a king!" he screamed at her, his voice breaking hoarsely. "I can feel you're not a king. I can taste it. Who do you think you are?" "Ash!" the Duchessa gasped, with tears in her eyes. "Ashel, please!" The lictors had finally made it aboard the pavilion, and now threw themselves to their lady's defence, dragging the Duconte from her and holding him fast between three of them, while a fourth helped the Duchessa to her feet, shielding her torn gown from the populace with his black and scarlet cloak. "You're not a king," the mad Duconte screamed at the Duchessa. Where did you get that dress? Whose hands knitted those roses? Whose fingers trimmed those ribbons? Velody clung to the cold wood of the hitching post, feeling hollow inside. The dress was spoiled. It could only ever have been worn once, so it shouldn't matter, but somehow it mattered dreadfully. That, and it appeared to have driven a man mad. He got to you, the Ducant howled. 5 years in exile for what? New tortures, new games? What is this, Garnet? He's not making any sense, Velody thought lightheadedly. Why would anyone stop him? What have you done to my scars? Screamed the mad Ducant. Scars? Muttered a seller of rose dumplings near Velody. Oh, scars. What have Garnet's got to do with anything? Agreed her friend. Boy's gone daft. And that poor dress, Sally, I could weep. They were mine, screamed the Ducant, struggling against the firm grip of the lictors. You're with them, Isangel. You've been consorting with kings. Who gave you that dress? The lictors tried to manhandle him off the float and away from the Duchessa, but the Ducant held his ground, not allowing them to budge him. One lictor made the mistake of drawing the sharp axe that was bound to his bundle of rods. The Ducant let out a blood-curdling growl and started fighting for real. To the surprise and evident enjoyment of the mob, he turned out to be rather good at it. He flipped two lictors to the ground with great force and slammed another against the side of the pavilion. The fourth was hurled back against the huddled, weeping figure of the Duchessa. The crowd hissed as the Ducant made an impossible leap towards the rooftop of the courier. His hands scrabbled wildly on the guttering, but he made it with a helpful hand from the man in brown, who hauled him upwards. The two of them ran up the slope of the roof and vanished over the other side, out of view of the crowd in the forum. And that was all. The crowd began to disperse. A few remained to watch the gulping Duchessa pull herself together. Some shouted up helpful advice to the lictors about how best to comfort a crying woman, but these soon descended into bawdy remarks. Delphine made her way back to Velody, her eyes shining. What did you make of all that?
I don't know, said Velody. She didn't want to explain about the scars or the golden light or the strange look that the man in brown had given her.
Your poor dress, Delphine said, giving her friend a hug. What a brute! Gorgeous man, but you can't respect a fellow who damages good frocks for no reason.
Doesn't matter, Velody mumbled. Let's go home.
Last time something went wrong at a Floralia parade, we had the worst summer harvest on record, Delphine said chattily, as she wound her arm into Velody's. It rained for 3 months, do you remember? And that was just because the sacrificial bull wasn't drugged heavily enough and sprayed blood on the damaskin virgins. For a mad spring consort and a half-ravished spring queen, we'll probably have sleet from Lucina to Cerealis.
Velody buried her face in her hands. She could not wipe away the image of the mad Ducant, screaming as the scars tore themselves from his hands and face.
Is he mad? I saw it too. Perhaps we're both mad.
Still, you have to look on the bright side, said Delphine with relish. No one will forget what the Duchessa wore to this parade.
Okay, thanks for listening to Sheep Might Fly. And if this chapter intrigues you, you can pre-order copies of the Creature Court trilogy and the new novella set in the same world over at my Kickstarter. Currently still at 75%. Okay, before I go, and I know this has been a long episode, that chapter was way longer than I remembered. That's what that's epic fantasy for you. I'm so used to the novellas these days. The last serial that I did on the podcast, Let Sleeping Princes Lie, is currently available as a pre-order on Kindle. It drops at the end of the month. And I'll be setting it up on Smashwords 2 as well, which will help reach the other ebook platforms like Kobo, etc. Or if you subscribe to my Patreon, you get to download the ebook straight away, because that's a big part of what the Patreon rewards are. You get the books first and you get them straight away. And yeah, for a monthly subscription, which could be as little as $1 a month. Okay, that's enough spruiking. I'll see you next week for more Creature Court goodness of some kind. I haven't decided what I'm going to do. And then the week after, we'll be starting with Cookie Cutter Superheroes, just for a bit of a change of pace. You can sign up to my author newsletter for updates. Follow me on Twitter at TansyRR or at Sheep Might Fly. Find me on Facebook at TansyRR Books. And if you like this podcast, consider supporting me, as I mentioned, at Patreon, where you can receive all kinds of cool rewards, early ebooks, exclusive stories for a small monthly pledge. See you next week.